This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The kind of complicated physics that Stephen Hawking thinks about should be accessible to only a slim percentage of the world's population. But such is the genius of the celebrated cosmologist that his books are bestsellers and his persona so well known and respected that he's made animated appearances on The Simpsons.
Wow, I can't believe someone I never heard of is hanging out with a guy like me.
All right, it's closing time. Who's paying the tab?
I am.
I didn't say that.
Yes, I did. So.
All right, anyone who's interested in black holes or the beginning of the universe has heard of Stephen Hawking. He also captured the public's imagination because of his perseverance in the face of adversity. Lou Gehrig's disease, mostly known as ALS these days, confines Hawking to a wheelchair. He has extremely limited movement. A computer helps him speak. Kitty Ferguson is a writer whose personal and professional life was profoundly influenced by Hawking. She was a musician before she got her hands on a copy of Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time. She read it and decided to leave music for a career as a science writer. Many successful books later, she returned to write a new biography of the man who inspired her passion for science. Her new book is called Stephen Hawking, An Unfettered Mind, and Kitty Ferguson joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Tell us now, for those, anyone who might not be familiar with Stephen Hawking, who is he and why should we know about him?
Well, he is one of our top physicists in the world, but most people's image of him is a man sitting rather very helplessly in a wheelchair, slumped in a wheelchair, and very often on television shown in that wheelchair on a background of stars and galaxies and black holes. And I think the one reason why he has captured the public imagination so much is that he has a passion for explaining his science as well as he can. Some people say not well enough, but as well as he can to everybody. He wants to share it. And he doesn't just want to share his science. He wants to share the fun of it and the adventure of it. And that has been a huge theme that has run through his whole life, his own enjoyment of his science and the way he wants to convey that to others.
How did you get interested in Stephen Hawking?
Well, I read A Brief History of Time, his best-selling book that has made the Guinness Book of World Records for how many copies it sold, and became truly fascinated with this science. Now, many people said they couldn't understand that book. I found that I had to work hard, but I could understand it, and I found it very funny. My husband would look over at me. I'd be sitting there giggling. He said, I can't imagine what anybody's finding to giggle about in that book. But Stephen Hawking is very witty, and it comes through in that book. Reading that, I became very interested in him, in his science, in that whole realm of science. I didn't just read him. I read a lot of other people. And our daughter, who was 8 years old at that time, decided to do, probably with a little push from me, do a science project on black holes for her science fair at her school. So she brought home these tomes on science, one called Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler Gravitation. Any physics student knows that big black book. But she couldn't really understand it, but I could read it a bit, and we danced around the living room pretending we were photons, pretending we were particle pairs about to drop into a black hole. I recently met Dr. Misner, and explained that to him. And he said, you know, I think you're the only person that's ever choreographed that.
And for an 8-year-old, the possibility of finding a place where no one could find you and you may be lost to them forever must have been quite a discovery.
I'm sure that's true. Her project was a big success. And that's when I decided to try to write, first of all, for children. I wrote my first book was, well, for children, 12 to 16-year-olds on black holes.
Well, let's talk about that theory, the theory of black holes, not so much the theory of black holes themselves, but something called Hawking radiation, which has stirred a lot of imaginations. What is it and why is that so important?
Well, that's probably among his colleagues, that is considered his most important contribution to science. It was, and actually it was a good example of the way he tends to pull the rug out from under his own feet, because he'd previously concluded that the area of the event horizon of a black hole can never get smaller. Nothing can ever come out of a black hole, so it can't get smaller. And then he came up with this Hawking radiation theory, which was a great surprise to him that he found anything could come out, and certainly a surprise to his colleagues. At first, it was very controversial. He got a lot of flack for it. but it is now considered, you know, it's well received and well considered and by the whole community. What it actually is, if you want to sort of a rough and ready explanation, what my daughter and I danced around the living room pretending, is that everywhere and at all times in the vacuum of space, there are fluctuations which can be pictured as a pair of particles, virtual particles, that start together and then go apart and then after a very short period of time, too short to imagine, they come back together and they annihilate one another. Now, if those happen to be near the border of a black hole, near the event horizon of a black hole, the chance is that one of them will fall into the black hole. And if that happens, then it doesn't have to reemerge. It doesn't have to get together with its former partner. It doesn't have to annihilate, which means its former partner can escape then to a distance from the black hole. And that is seen then as Hawking radiation. And it doesn't actually come from inside the black hole. It's sort of a mathematical trick that allows this to subtract anything from the black hole. And that's because the particle that went in perhaps had negative energy. Mm. Take negative energy into the hole. That translates to negative mass. A minus sign, less mass, a smaller black hole. And that is a very rough description.
So that explains how mathematically anyway we can find something coming out, negative energy going in, or maybe we would have predicted that both of these partners would have gone in together. That's what should
sometimes
be in there.
Sometimes they do.
And sometimes they do. But when they don't, we can sort of watch one of them flee the sight of the event horizon. But that still creates a problem ultimately because it meant that the black hole would ultimately evaporate. Right?
That's right, yes. And that caused Hawking to worry about something called what he called the information paradox. Because when things fall into a black hole, they're still in the universe. We don't know what they are, but they're still in our universe. But once the black hole evaporates with all that stuff still in it, what has happened to it? It seems to have disappeared from the universe. Now you might think, well, what's in a black hole? The star that collapsed, maybe, you know, traditionally an astronaut that fell in shouldn't have been there in the first place, but knew better. A few unmatched socks, that's what people say are in black holes. Okay, so why is this a huge problem, you know, that this should be lost to our universe? But yeah, information cannot be lost from the universe without causing a great difficulty with scientific predictions and even with our everyday concept of cause and effect. That's affected. And so it's a serious business.
As a conservation of matter.
It's a conservation
of – we just can't lose anything.
Right. We can't lose anything, no.
So how does he explain that? He said, uh-oh, you've just broken a law and everything that we've written depends on that law. And yeah. Stephen, you've ruined us.
He took a long time to come around with an explanation. And meanwhile, there had been other explanations that had been proposed. I think in the end he felt, you know, I started this problem. I will solve it. And so his explanation of it, which many people found very unsatisfactory, he wrote it up in a paper that was only 3 pages, I think, with 2 equations. And they thought, surely there must be more than this. It's sort of smoke and mirrors sort of a solution. And his solution of it, though, just to put very briefly, was that if you imagine the universe having many possible histories, many possible ways it could have gotten to where it is, many possible histories. Some of those histories, if you imagine even so many different universes, some will have black holes, some will not have black holes. And the way he sees it, the ones without black holes will cancel out in the total equation those with black holes, and so we don't have to worry about the information being lost. Now, if you find that difficult or unsatisfactory, so do most of his colleagues. It doesn't quite work out to their satisfaction.
But it's one way of explaining it, and it is sympathetic with other theories that there are multiple paths that the present
sums over histories, many histories of the same universe or many universes.
So it's one thing to become enamored of the science and realize that you're a good communicator, but then you decided that you had to meet Stephen Hawking yourself and become his biographer. How did that transpire? Tell us about the process.
Well, it was interesting. I was over in Cambridge. My husband and I were over there quite frequently. And I decided I needed to talk with him. Actually, I wanted to talk with him also about the little black hole book I was writing because I consulted with some of his students and had a couple of questions they really couldn't answer. So I thought I would go to him with this. So I had difficulty really getting an interview. He always has a sort of gatekeeper, his public, you know, his secretary or his PA. But I did manage to circumvent her. and arrange through his graduate assistant to come in one evening to meet him in his office. He often stays quite late. So I remember that very vividly. The common room where his office is was dark, and there was only light was just the light coming from around his door. And the woman who had brought me there from reception in the building was standing by me, and I said, "Well, should I knock?" And she said very timidly, "I have no idea."
So, I've never been in there.
That's right. So, and usually when people go to meet Stephen Hawking, they have someone brief them a little bit. You know, tell them you're going to sit on the same side of the desk with him. You're not going to sit across from him. You're going to be looking at his computer screen where he chooses the words that he's communicating with. You're going to see all this. You may at times know what word he's chasing, what he's trying to say, but don't interrupt him. Don't complete his sentences for him. That's not considered polite, and he'll probably complete them anyway. Things like that. Mm-hmm. But and then as soon as you see the words in a sentence across the bottom of his screen, then you can continue the conversation. You don't have to wait for his synthetic voice to say them. I mean, this is all just simple things you'd like to know if you're going to go into.
But this is the briefing you didn't get.
I didn't get that briefing, no. And I went in, and the only other person there was a young man, his carer for that night, who was there also for the first time. So we were both completely at sea. So I didn't know whether I should start the conversation, but I could see, I could hear that Stephen was clicking his little handheld device, which is how he, at that time, he was choosing the words. So I waited, and then that synthetic voice said, "Hello." And gradually I became comfortable. He's comfortable with the situation, so you become comfortable with it too. It's very peaceful. It's a quiet, you just hear that clicking. It's quiet, peaceful, but it's also energy charged. It's an interesting experience being with him.
But you were a stranger now in his midst. But did
he
know why you were there? I mean,
oh, yes, he knew why I was there.
So
yes,
you did get
yes,
word to him.
That's right. And I actually, on that occasion, I read him a couple of little excerpts from the book I was writing about black holes and realized while I was reading them, I thought, this is so dull. And so I stopped and I said, this is so dull. But my editor, and I said, this is my first book. And my editor says, science is serious. It must be treated seriously. It's not to be fun. And so ooh. I thought, well, and I said to him, and he said, it should be fun. And I said, but what can I do? And he said, tell him I said so. And believe me, that solved my problem.
That'll do it. So what was he like? Did he take time with you?
He did. He took a lot of time. He's always been very patient when I've taken things into him to have him read things I've written about his theories to make sure they're right. I try when I ask him a question to phrase it in a way he can answer yes or no, because that makes it much simpler. But he very seldom stops with that. You know, he will go on from that. But that's the way I do it. I say, would you say this? And he will say, yes, but, you know, and then he will go on from there. But that's the best way to deal with it. Also, you realize you're only going to get through about 3 questions in an hour.
Because he's got a lot to say.
Because it's so slow.
Oh, that's the process.
Yes, I see. It's 10. It was at the best times, which was when I first met him. It was 10 or 15 words per minute. Now it's down to about one word in maybe 1 minute to 5 minutes. It's very slow indeed.
And it's not that he's typing answers.
No, he's choosing it word by word on his computer screen.
So it's a process of elimination. It's kind of a sculpting process.
Yes, he has to choose, first of all, the section of the screen where the word is, then the line where the word is, then the word itself as the cursor moves across. And if he misses it, it starts over. And it moves very fast. It's like a video game. You're watching and you think, come on, Stephen, get it.
So this is your second biography of Hawking.
That's right.
What was wrong with the first one?
Nothing was wrong.
It was a fine book.
It was a splendid book, but it was short. It was short. It was, and also it ended in 1989. Yeah. That's when I wrote it.
And this book includes a little bit more about his personal life, including his relationship with his wives.
That's right.
Tell us about that, and because the story, his trajectory as a gifted scientist who had everything and maybe not working to his potential, then coming down with ALS, how that changed him, the impact of his first wife, all very important.
It certainly changed his disease certainly changed his life. I think he probably would say himself that he would not be where he is today in his science had he not had Lou Gehrig's disease.
And why?
Because he was not very dedicated to anything at that time. He was a very casual student, brilliant but slipshod, and didn't see much purpose to life, much purpose to work. But when he realized that he probably had only 2 years to live, and suddenly life became very precious. Every minute became precious, and he realized there were worthwhile things that he wanted to do. And then he met Jane Wilde, who it's interesting, it's a very touching and moving story, really, because their courtship and their marriage was in the context of his coming to terms with his illness. And, of course, coming to terms with it, it lasted, you know, his life has gone on. He's just had his 70th birthday. But at that time, they thought he had 2 years to live, which she says didn't bother them too much because this was when everyone was expecting the world to end in a nuclear explosion any time. So people were living as though they only had 2 years to live. That's what she says. But she was a huge, huge help to him. I don't think he would be where he is without her. She was just marvelous.
And then when he got where he is, that was part of what broke them apart.
It was, because he loves celebrity. He loves traveling around the world. He's a real ham. He does love this. He wouldn't have to do all these appearances and stuff if he didn't want to. He's got plenty of money now he could do, but he loves doing that. And she saw it as such a triumph that he should just live a normal life in their home doing his work and could not share this other life and all the media, all the stuff, you know, that was breaking into their family life. And that's really, I think, and also I think having cared for him in the way she did for all those years, you know, and very often with him refusing to hire or get in any extra help because he felt it was an invasion of their privacy. Mm-hmm. So she ended up always, you know, folding the wheelchair, packing it into the car, getting it out, bathing him, doing everything under the sun like that. I mean, it was quite a life.
He did get some help, a nurse.
Yes, he did finally. And then when he lost his vocal cords, they had an operation to do. Then that actually saved his life, but he couldn't talk anymore. After that, he needed 24-hour-a-day nursing. So that's what they've had ever since.
I would like you, if you will, to read actually from the first chapter of your book. A little passage that I think in many ways, if you think about Stephen Hawking, the complexity of his theories, what he's trying to accomplish, it's possible that this may sum it up pretty well, if you would read this for us.
Sure. Excuse me. Hawking's life story and his science are rife with paradoxes. Things are often not what they seem. Here is a tale in which beginnings are endings. Cruel circumstances lead to happiness, although fame and success may not. Two brilliant and highly successful scientific theories taken together yield nonsense. Empty space isn't empty after all, and black holes aren't black. In the 21st century, the effort to unite everything in a simple explanation is revealing instead a fragmented picture. And most paradoxical of all, a man whose physical appearance inspires shock and pity has led us joyfully to where the boundaries of time and space ought to be, but are not. Everywhere we look in our universe, on all scales, reality, if Hawking will allow me to use this word, reality is astoundingly complex and elusive, sometimes alien, often not easy to take, and frequently impossible to predict. Beyond our universe, there may be an infinite number of others. The close of the 20th century has come and gone, and no one has discovered the theory of everything. Where does that leave Stephen Hawking's prediction? Can any scientific theory truly explain it all?
Kitty Ferguson from her new book, Stephen Hawking, An Unfettered Mind. And certainly I've only got about 30 seconds left, but I think he's a man himself who would embrace the theory that we have to hold paradox together and maybe not sum it up in a simple sentence.
He would.
Kitty Ferguson, what a pleasure. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you.
Kitty Ferguson's new book is called Stephen Hawking, An Unfettered Mind. For more information about Kitty, you can go to Kitty, KITTY-Ferguson.com. Just ahead, novelist Drew talks with us. Drew McGarry is here to talk with us and show us a world where death is optional. Stay with us on The State of Things.